American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more, right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Greetings, fellow lovers of the dark and macabre. Looking for more thrilling tales of true crime and suspense?
Then step aboard the murder coaster.
I'm Krista Carmen.
And I'm Matthew Brockmire.
And every week we bring you spine-chilling and disturbing true tales of murder and mayhem.
So strap in.
Keep your hands and feet inside the ride.
And prepare for a descent into the darkest realms of true crime.
On Murder Coaster Podcast.
Murder Coaster Podcast, available everywhere you get podcasts.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Abgenommen bedauert.
And thank you all for tuning in.
If you enjoyed that trailer, please check out the True Crime Podcast, Murder Coaster. Use the links in the description below. Now for us, we have an all-new Volume 1, Dr. Gideon Fell. Created in 1933 by John Dixon Carr, and this detective was star of over 20 novels. And now, you get to listen to the radio adventures. This is a Volume 1, so please give me your feedback on this episode, whether through the comments on Spotify, or the many ways to get a hold of me in the links below. And don't forget to follow, review, and rate the podcast. And a big thank you to all those that already have. Now, with all that out of the way, please enjoy the show.
So, after your evening in the saloon bar, you were found fast asleep on a sofa at Northfield Hall. Can you tell us how you got there?
No, I don't remember that part at all.
Well, perhaps you'll tell us the part you can remember.
Let me think. When I woke up, I knew where I was because the moon was shining in through the windows, so that was all right.
All right. Didn't it strike you as odd that you were in someone else's house?
Well, it used to be my house, Superintendent. I just thought, hello, I'm home. And that's when I saw this chap walking along the corridor.
It would help us if you could describe him.
He was wearing a uniform, the way they do at big hotels, like the Royal. Dark blue, with a long jacket and silver buttons. That's all I can tell you.
Not quite. You didn't describe his face.
I can't tell you anything about his face. I can only remember a dark shadow, a sort of black hole where his eyes should have been.
We present To Wake the Dead, a Dr. Fell mystery by John Dixon Carr, dramatized for radio by Peter Ling. With Donald Sinden as Dr. Fell. Part 1. The Riddle of the Stone.
Extracts from notes made by me, Gideon Fell, on Saturday, May the 1st, 1937, on one of the strangest cases ever investigated by my friend, Superintendent Hadley. It involved young Christopher Kent, a wealthy Australian. He was an amateur criminologist. We'd corresponded on several occasions, but I'd never met him until he arrived in my study at Adelphi Terrace.
Good morning, Doctor. I'm Christopher Kent. And I'm in one hell of a mess.
Are you indeed? And before you go any further, perhaps I should warn you. This is my colleague, Superintendent Hatley, of the Criminal Investigation Department.
Good morning, Mr. Kent. I think you'd better come and sit down.
Thanks.
Now, what have you got to tell us?
I'm supposed to meet an old friend for dinner tonight, Dan Reaper. He's a businessman from Sydney, a big noise there. He's fixed up a party of his friends and family to come over to London for the Regal Razzle Dazzle.
The Regal Razzle? Do you mean the coronation?
Visitors from overseas are pouring in every day. And, is Mr. Reaper planning to join in the celebrations?
Oh, and how? He's a great guy. Sort of the earth, old Dan. And the most stubborn, pig-headed cuss you ever met. And that's why I'm in a jam right now. One day we got into an argument walking along by the harbour, on account of me saying I was planning to take up criminology as a career.
A career? You? Get away. You've never had to earn your own living. You couldn't do an honest day's work if you tried.
What are you talking about? Of course I could. Just because my old man's made a bit of money, well, that doesn't mean that...
I'll tell you what it means. It means you don't know how to buckle down to a real job of work.
I could if I tried.
Let's have a bet on it. You'll be in London 2 months from now, right? With the rest of us.
You know I will.
Well, I bet you couldn't start from here without a penny in your pocket. Make your way to London and meet me there. I've got to go down to Sir Giles Grey's place in the country first, but I'll be up in London at the beginning of May. Meet me for dinner at our hotel, 8 p.m. Saturday, May the 1st, without cashing a cheque or using your dad's name to help you on your way, and I'll give you £1,000. How about it?
So I said okay. I was determined to prove him wrong. And I did pretty well, until yesterday.
What happened yesterday?
I arrived on the SS Volspar at Tilbury with a trimmer's pay in my back pocket. And last night I blew the lot on one glorious binge with my messmates. At breakfast time this morning, I was outside the Royal Hotel without a penny to my name, starving hungry with 12 hours to go before my deadline.
Just a minute. Did you say the Royal Hotel?
Yes, near Piccadilly Circus. Dan had booked some rooms there for his party. Why?
It's just a coincidence. Please, carry on.
And I'll tell you another thing. This may be May Day, but there was a darn cold wind blowing. When I saw a flake of white sailing down through the air, I thought it was starting to snow. But it wasn't. It was a card. This card.
The Royal Hotel, room 707 double, 21 shillings and sixpence. This charge includes room, bath and breakfast.
Breakfast. That did it. It had just gone 7:30. With any luck, the occupants of room 707 wouldn't be up and about yet. Okay, it was fraud, but my stomach was rumbling. I showed the waiter the card, and he brought my bacon and eggs without a word. But, just as I was finishing, a gent in pinstripes came over to my table.
I wonder, might I have a word with you, sir?
Yes. What is it?
I'm sorry to trouble you, but you are the gentleman from 707...
That's right.
Of course. The room you're in was occupied until 2 days ago by an American lady who is sailing home to New York this evening. She rang late last night, but we didn't like to disturb you until this morning. She'd just discovered she'd left behind a valuable bracelet. She put it in the back of the bureau drawer and forgot about it. I know it's an imposition, but if we find the bracelet, we could get it to Southampton in time to catch the boat. Would you mind coming upstairs with me to look in the bureau?
The thing is, I've got to go out right away, an appointment. But you have my permission to go up and find the bracelet.
Well, under the circumstances, I hardly
what
like
circumstances?
To... Your good lady being asleep and having hung a quiet sign on the door. It wouldn't do for us to disturb her. But it won't take more than a few moments, I'm sure. If you wouldn't mind coming up with me, you can go in first and explain to your wife.
I didn't have any choice. With the manager at my elbow, I made my way into one of the lifts and we ascended slowly to the top floor.
I'm sorry the other lift isn't functioning at present. You probably noticed we have workmen repairing the winding gear at the top of the shaft, but it should be operating again by this afternoon. We've had two teams of engineers working all round the clock in order to get the job done as soon as possible. I hope they didn't disturb you last night.
Oh, no, not at all.
I'm afraid I seem to have left my key in the room.
Don't worry.
I have passed keys to every door. Ah, here we are. After you.
The corridor was L-shaped, and room 707 was on the inner corner. Just around that corner was the door to 707, where the manager produced a key ring. As he selected a key, I noticed the quiet label on the doorknob, and saw that someone had scrawled two words across it in red ink. Dead woman. Perhaps it was meant as a joke, but somehow it sickened me. I turned it round so the back of the card was showing where the manager unlocked the door.
After you, sir.
If you'd just wait here a moment.
Of course, sir. As I said, you'll find the bracelet at the back of the bureau drawer.
Thank you. I expected to find an indignant couple sitting up and yelling at me, but the room was silent, and the bed had not been slept in. And nothing stirred, except the hairs at the back of my neck. As I realized that the sign outside the door had not been a joke. In the middle of the room, there was a wardrobe trunk.
What?
And the kind that stands up on end and opens out like a book. It was partly open. On the floor lay the body of a woman. A towel draped over her shoulders, and her head in between the halves of the trunk. I went closer, and saw that the towel around her neck had been used to strangle her. But that was not the worst. Her face had been heavily battered until it was unrecognizable. And then there was a knock at the door. The manager was getting impatient. I had to do something. I went to the bureau and opened the drawer. I had a vague idea of grabbing the bracelet, opening the door and handing it over just to get rid of him. But I couldn't even do that.
Well, of course, the drawer was empty.
How did you know that? Anyway, now I really was in a panic. Until I noticed there was another door in the room. A door in the side wall. We'd passed it on our way from the lift. In a jiffy, I was through that door and running downstairs, and I never stopped running till I got here. You've got to believe me. I swear, I didn't kill that woman. Look, I know it was a fool to cut and run like that, but...
It wasn't the best of plans, but I don't suppose there's been any great harm done. Provided you could answer one question. Hadley.
Yes, and never mind last night. Where were you a fortnight ago? The night of April the 15th.
Like I told you, on board the SS Volspar.
That should be easy enough to prove. What do you think, Doctor?
I think I do not like this business. It's brutal and unreasonable. But I feel sure that you are telling us the truth.
Thank you. Though I don't quite see why...
I'm afraid we've already heard your story. The report of that woman's death was phoned through to me just a short while before you arrived. And I must tell you some bad news. The woman whose face had been so cruelly battered was Josephine Kent, the wife of your cousin, Rodney Kent, two of the people who travelled from Australia with your friend Dan Reaper.
That woman was Jenny Kent?
Josephine Kent.
She hated that name. We all called her Jenny. I can't believe it. There must be some mistake.
I'm afraid not. Mr. Reaper's party arrived at the Royal Hotel a couple of days ago. He'd taken all the rooms on the top floor.
The whole party? You mean they were all there?
Did you know Mrs. Kent well?
No, she wasn't the sort you get to know well. But she had a special quality, very attractive. Rod simply... Oh, God. Where was he when it happened? The poor devil worshipped her. Oh, this'll just about kill him.
No, he's been spared that at least. Hadley, I think you'd better explain the situation.
Very well. The fact is, we already knew about Mr. Reaper's wager a fortnight ago. He told us himself. We tried to get in touch with you then because... Well, I'm sorry to have to break it to you like this. On the night of April the 15th, while Mr. Reaper's party were staying in Sussex as guests of Sir Giles Grey, your cousin Rodney was murdered in exactly the same way that his wife was murdered last night.
If I'd had any doubts about the young man's innocence, they would have disappeared when I saw the colour drain from his face. The news had come as a terrible shock. Mr. and Mrs. Kent were a popular couple, happily married, and as far as anyone knew, without an enemy in the world. They certainly had none in England, for neither of them had ever been out of Australia before. Yet someone patiently stalked them and killed them, one at a house party in Sussex, the other at the Royal Hotel.
I still can't believe it. It makes no sense at all. Haven't you any idea who's responsible?
Well, there's a fellow we've got in jail, not on a murder charge. That's part of the reason he's inside. A chap called Bellows, Richie Bellows. A good deal of evidence points to him as the murderer of Rodney Kent, but I can tell you one thing for sure. Whether or not he killed Mr. Kent, he couldn't have killed Mrs. Kent because he's been in jail for the past fortnight.
Yeah, but if I might remind you, in Bellows' statement, he claimed that...
Bellows' statement can't be true. In the first place, his fingerprints were found in the room where Kent was killed. In the second place, any man, drunk or sober, who says he saw a uniformed hotel attendant walking through Giles Gray's house in Sussex at 2 o'clock in the morning...
What?
By the way, have you met Sir Giles Gray?
No, I've heard Dan speak about him. He's something in the government, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he used to be an undersecretary at the Commonwealth Office. But after he retired, he left London and bought a house at Northfields, on the Kent-Sussex border. I gather that he and Mr. Reaper have known each other for years.
That's right. They've got some sort of property deal going. That's why the party went down to spend some time at Northfield Hall. Now, there were five of them. Sir Giles, Mr. and Mrs. Reaper and their niece Francine, plus Rodney Kent.
And his wife, Jenny.
No, she wasn't there. She had two aunts living in Dorset, whom she'd never met, so she went down to visit them for a while. She only rejoined Mr. Reaper's party a couple of days ago, in London.
Where does this chap Richie Bellows fit in?
I was just coming to that. His father, Richard Bellows Sr., had been a great character in Northfields, an architect and a builder. By the time he died, he'd remade most of the village.
How do you mean?
Well, his speciality was restoring old buildings or creating new ones. Replicas of Tudor or Stuart houses, which would deceive the most knowledgeable historian. He really enjoyed that. He had quite a sense of humour. He was forever putting in hidden doors and secret passages.
Oh, Lord, oh, Bucks! You never told me that.
Before you start jumping to conclusions, I can say, with my hand on my heart, that there are no secret passages or anything of that kind in Northfield Hall. He built that for his own pleasure, and lived there for 20-odd years until he died, when Sir Giles Grey moved in.
You still haven't told me about his son.
Oh, Richard Bellows Jr. Well, he's a problem. He was brought up at Northfield Hall, and he's a brilliant chap in his way, with amazing powers of observation, a photographic memory. If you riffle through a pack of cards, he can name every card he saw in order. Sir Giles asked him round to amuse his guests soon after they arrived.
But you say he's a problem.
Well, so he is. When the old man died, he was left very well off. But he's bone idle. He blames that on the fact that he has a paralysed left arm, which gives him an excuse to laze around doing nothing. After he started hitting the bottle, everything went wrong. The slump nearly bankrupted him, and his wife died of typhoid in some foreign holiday resort. He had to sell the hall for a song. He's been living in digs since then, and he's become the village drunk. Sir Giles was sorry for him, and invited him to drop in whenever he liked. He still has his own key.
Yes, and whenever he gets drunk, he wanders back to the old place automatically.
And he was there the night Rod was killed.
He spent the evening at the pub, as usual, until they turned him out. Then he took a bottle of scotch with him and was last seen heading for the churchyard.
When Dan Reaper got up to go to the bathroom, he saw Bellows stretched out on a sofa in the corridor, dead drunk. So he knocked on Sir Giles's door, and together they tried to rouse Bellows. He said it was like trying to wake the dead. Then they saw Rodney Kent's door was open.
They found your cousin lying at the foot of the large four-poster bed, strangled, with a hand towel round his neck. His face had been bashed with a dozen blows from a blunt instrument, which so far has not been found.
So you arrested Bellows?
Only on a charge of housebreaking. We had no evidence against him, and as I told you, his left arm is paralysed.
Yeah. The doctor said it would be impossible for him to strangle anyone. Moreover, he had no motive for killing Rodney Kent, who was a stranger to him.
We interrogated him next day in his cell at the local police station, but without much success.
So, you were found fast asleep on a sofa at Northfield Hall. Can you tell us how you got there?
No, I can't remember that part at all.
Perhaps you'll tell us the part you can remember.
Let me think. When I woke up, I knew where I was because the moon was shining in through the windows. So that was all right.
All right? Didn't it strike you as odd that you were in someone else's house?
Well, it used to be my house, Superintendent. No, I just thought, hello, I'm home. And that's when I saw this chap walking along the corridor.
It would help us if you could describe him.
He was wearing a uniform, the way they do at big hotels, like the Royal. Dark blue, with a long jacket and silver buttons. That's all I can tell you.
Not quite. You didn't describe his face.
I can't tell you anything about his face. I can only remember a dark shadow, a sort of black hole where his eyes should have been. He just walked on into the darkness, and I couldn't see him anymore. Oh, and he was carrying a little tray, the sort they use for visiting cards. Something about the way he walked put me in mind of a hotel attendant.
Hotel attendant?
Didn't it surprise you to see a hotel attendant walking through a private house in the middle of the night?
I never really thought about it. I just rolled over and went back to sleep.
Nonsensical, isn't it? A silver salver. For what? For carrying a weapon? Mind you, I'm not saying Bellows is imagining things, but if he's telling the truth, where are we?
Don't forget, your village drunk is the man who can describe a shop window full of articles after one glance. Mm. If we can persuade him to remember what he really saw, we may get at the truth.
Well, I suppose it's possible that Bellows murdered Mr. Kent that night, and someone else used the same method in the story about a phantom hotel attendant to kill Mrs. Kent a fortnight later.
Do you really believe that?
I don't know what I believe. But the same people were present at the hotel. Mr. and Mrs. Reaper and her niece Francine Forbes, Sir Giles Grey.
Grey came up to London with them. Why?
For the coronation. I understand he's used his influence to book a row of seats on one of the balconies along the mall.
I see. Talking of Jenny, after Rod was killed, couldn't she tell you anything to throw some light on it?
No. As I say, she was with her aunts in Dorset when it happened. She was half out of her mind when we found her and broke the news. She stayed on in the care of the local GP until she was well enough to rejoin the party in London. And a couple of nights later, last night, in fact, she was murdered. Well, Doctor, can you make any sense of it?
Not at present, I'm sorry to say. I can only indicate a few points that seem interesting. I'm interested in towels. I'm interested in buttons. And I'm interested in names.
Names?
Or their permutations. Now, might I suggest that we make a start by visiting the hotel?
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm Kenneth Hardwick, the duty manager. I'm very pleased to meet you, even under such unhappy circumstances. If you'd care to come into the office, perhaps we can discuss the situation.
Thank you. After you, Mr. Kent.
Dr. Fell, would you like this chair?
No, I think the sofa will suit me better.
As you wish. Now then, Superintendent, you were inquiring about Mr. Reaper's party.
Yes. Now, I understand he reserved one entire wing on the top floor.
That is so. I have a ground plan here. It shows the layout of the rooms. Room 707 on the corner is where the body was found. As Mr. Kent already knows.
I'm not likely to forget it.
If you'd explained the situation at the time.
Never mind that. I notice room 707 faces 701 and 2. According to this, they're occupied by Mr. and Mrs. Reaper, and 703 and 4 are Sir Giles Grey's suite.
Yes, and opposite, next to 707, is 706.
Miss Francine Forbes, Mrs. Reaper's niece.
So Fran must have been in her room while Mrs. Kent was attacked next door.
Apparently the young lady is a sound sleeper. And the walls are thick. They have to be to muffle the sounds of traffic in the street.
There seems to be one room you've overlooked. Number 705, round the corner, in between the fire escape and the linen cupboard. There's no name against room 705.
That room was provisionally reserved for you, Mr. Kent. Mr. Reaper was hoping you would arrive, but as he hadn't heard from you, it's still vacant.
It's ironic, isn't it? If you'd only known about it this morning, you could have had your own room and your own breakfast.
I gather that until 2 days ago, 707 had been occupied by an American lady who claims she left a bracelet in the bureau.
Mrs. Jopley Down, yes. Though I don't know why you put it like that, she did leave her bracelet there. I found it myself when I went in and found Mrs. Kent.
But that's impossible.
I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry. I looked in the bureau this morning, and I swear on a stack of Bibles there was no bracelet in that drawer.
I can only say that's where I found it. It's in my desk now. There you are.
May I see that?
It was a curious design. Broad links of white gold with one stone set in the centre. Square, black, with two lines of Roman script engraved upon it. In characters only just big enough to be legible.
My Latin's not up to much. Claudite jam rivos, pueri sat prater biberunt. Well, Doctor, what do you make of it?
No wonder she wants it back. The stone itself isn't particularly valuable. Obsidian, perhaps, or black opal. But a good many museums would like to get their hands on it. A rough and ready translation might be, cease your singing, lads. You've had enough recreation. It's one of the most ingenious devices of the ancient world.
Devices? You mean it's got a secret compartment full of poison, like a Borgia ring?
Oh, no, nothing like that. No, nothing of the sort. Though it's equally practical. Where is Mrs. Jopley Dunn now?
In Southampton. About to sail for New York. I'm trying to get in touch with her.
You must certainly do so. She'll be delighted to hear that it's safe.
Look, let's get back to business. I'm told you had men working on one of the lifts last night. If an outsider, and not one of Mr. Reaper's party, had gone into 707, would the workmen have seen him?
Oh, yes. An intruder could only have come up by the lift or the staircase, and they'd have been in full view.
Yes, but how about the fire escape round the corner? That's not visible from the lifts.
True, but that door can't be opened from the outside, for security reasons. So...
He was interrupted by an indignant middle-aged man, followed by a very attractive young lady.
Look here, Superintendent. How much longer are you going to keep us cooped up in our rooms like... Chris!
Mr. Reaper, I gather you already know Mr. Kent.
Yes, I know him very... Hang on, Chris, did you tell him who you are? Because if you did...
Oh, forget the damn bet. This is too serious to bother about that. Hello, Fran.
Hello.
So, you've heard the news. Rod and Jenny, both of them.
Yes, I heard. Superintendent Hadley told me all about it.
I just hope you can tell us something. How it happened. Why it happened.
As yet, I'm afraid we know very little ourselves. Mr. Reaper, for a start, can you tell me what you and your party were doing yesterday evening?
We all went to the theatre, Drury Lane. We got back about 11:15, didn't we?
Yeah, about that. We were all tired. We went straight up to our rooms.
And after that? Did either of you leave your rooms for any reason?
No, well, not exactly, though I stuck my head out to look along the hall.
Oh? Why was that?
The watch had stopped. There's a clock at the end of the passage.
What time would this have been?
About 2 minutes after midnight.
Did you see or hear anyone else in the corridor?
Only one of the hotel staff, outside Jenny's door, carrying a pile of bath towels.
One of the staff? A man in uniform?
Who could that have been? Would you know him if you saw him again?
I didn't see his face, because of the heap of towels. I'd say he was average height, in the hotel uniform, navy blue with silver buttons. Oh, you're thinking of the chap Bellows saw at Northfield Hall.
And there was a towel, wasn't there, when Rod was killed? What about Jenny? Was she...
Yes, a towel had been used to strangle her too.
For Pete's sake.
I'm sorry, Miss Forbes. I know this is very upsetting for you.
No, but... I'm all right. I just wish we could stop talking about it and find out who killed them.
A few minutes later, Hadley and I went up to examine room 707, taking Chris Kent with us. The policeman on duty unlocked the door, and as I went in, I noticed something rather odd.
Well, what are you scowling at?
This pair of shoes outside the door.
What about them? They must have been left out last night for polishing.
Yes, I saw them when I came up after breakfast.
Yes, but they weren't polished for a very good reason. They're made of brown suede. After you.
Yeah. The body's still here. I tell them not to touch anything until I...
She's been moved. Huh? Well, her head was inside the wardrobe trunk. I told you. Well, someone's pulled her out onto the carpet.
Who the devil could have... Hello. Look at these marks on her neck, Doctor. It strikes me this is a new method of murder.
Thin red wheels on both sides. So she wasn't strangled with the towel.
No. She was knocked unconscious and put between the jaws of the trunk, which were then pushed together. The blows to the face were presumably an afterthought. This is one murderer I'm going to catch if it's the last thing I do. What have we got there?
The dead woman sign. It was still hanging on the door. I wonder where the red ink came from.
Jenny's pen, I'd imagine. She always used red ink. I don't know why. You'll probably find it in her handbag. It's on the bedside table.
Let's have a look. That's odd. No money. But there is a pen with red ink.
Now, I take it you're not suggesting that she scribbled those words on the card herself.
Of course not.
Yeah, which means the murderer must have known where to find that fountain pen. Tell me now, was there a key in her bag?
No, why?
Well, she must have had a key to this room. I mean, it's not in the drawer. I wonder what happened to it.
I'm more concerned about what happened to the weapon. It's pretty clear that poor creature was attacked with repeated blows from a blunt instrument, face to face with her murderer.
Undoubtedly, exactly like Rodney Kent, beaten unconscious before being asphyxiated.
So if the murderer was carrying a weapon large enough to do that sort of damage, how was it that Mrs. Kent didn't scream, call for help, or put up some sort of struggle?
I wonder. I see there's something else that appears to have been overlooked.
What's that?
I walked across to the bedside table. Someone had placed a stack of bath towels upon it, snow white, fresh from the linen cupboard. Well, there must have been a dozen of them. I picked them up, one by one, and shook them out. Halfway down the pile, something fell to the carpet.
What the...
An iron poker, nearly 2 feet long, its head was flecked with lint, sticking to the dried stains of blood.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. Not only a good hiding place, but if you had one hand keeping a firm grip on the damn thing, and the towels hiding it from Mrs. Kent, you could whip it out and strike before she realized what was happening. Now what?
Dan Reaper said I'd find you here. I wondered if I could be of any assistance.
And you are...
Giles Gray, of Northfield Hall. I expect Dan told you. I've some China tea in my room, if you'd care for some refreshment.
Thank you, Sir Giles. I'm afraid we're rather busy at the moment.
Well, we're very glad to meet you. I've been hoping to have a word with you. As an outsider, an onlooker, so to speak, your views would be most interesting.
I fear I can't tell you much, Doctor. I know no more about this wretched business than I did about the murder in my own house.
But what can you tell us about Mr. Reaper's group? I mean, in general terms.
In general terms? I can only say, in all honesty, up to the moment Rodney Kent was killed, I'd never had so much fun in my entire life.
Fun?
Well, I'd been a minor government official, a city businessman. Pretty straight-laced life all round. When Dan and his friends entered my house, they turned it upside down. They strummed the piano, played childish games. One night, I found myself blindfolded, clumsily pinning a paper donkey's tail to Mrs. Reaper's derriere. And I loved every minute of it.
Until the night of the murder.
Yes, yes. I knew it was too good to last.
Hello, Giles.
I thought we were under orders to stay in our rooms till further notice.
Yes, Sir Giles is filling in a few additional details about your guests, Mr. Reaper. Their characters, their personalities.
That's no use. Giles only met them a couple of weeks ago. But I'll tell you who to ask, and that's my wife. Melita's what you might call a student of psychology. Isn't that so, Giles?
Oh, certainly. Mrs. Reaper is a shrewd observer of human nature. She's told me things about the Australians I'd never even dreamed of.
Yeah, well, let's not go into all that now. Besides, Melita's not just an expert on the Aussie character. She knows the mysterious secrets of the British as well, right?
I must admit it was Melita who pointed out that beneath my stiff collar and cuffs there lurks a rather unbuttoned sense of humour. But then one would expect her to understand the English, being English herself.
Oh, you must forgive me. I'd somehow taken it for granted that...
Oh, didn't I tell you? Yeah, Melita's from the old country, born and bred in a place called Leamington Spa. That's English, isn't it?
Definitely. Though Melita isn't a very common name in this country.
It's short for Carmelita. I believe she was the heroine of a novel by a lady called Ethel M. Dell. Melita's ma was a great one for novels. Anyhow, when her old man inherited one of the biggest sheep stations in Queensland, the family moved out there, lock, stock and barrel.
And that's when you met?
Well, what with her pa being in wool and me being pretty big in underwear...
I beg your pardon.
We met at a trade fair. I always say it was a pair of drawers that brought us together.
We seem to have strayed from the point somewhat. If we could just get back...
But that is the point. Like I said, Melita's a student of human nature. British as well as Australian. She'll tell you every little thing you want to know. Take my word for it.
And so, when Hadley had finished his work in room 707, we went over to 702 and introduced ourselves to Mrs. Reaper.
Oh, I know it's all very dreadful, Chris, but I must say it's rather inconsiderate. We were looking forward to a nice holiday, but it seems as if there's always something wherever I go. Did you have a nice trip out, dear?
Listen, Melita, the superintendent and Dr. Fell have a few questions they want to ask.
There are a couple of things we'd like to know.
Yeah, there are several things I'd like to know myself. I mean, the prices in the shops over here just take my breath away. I saw a hat in Bond Street yesterday. I could get the same thing in Sydney for half the price. Poor Jenny. She always had such pretty hats. Paris models, mostly.
Yes, we wanted to ask you about Jenny. Tell me, how would you describe her?
Oh, I know what you're going to say, but you mustn't believe everything Dan tells you. Men talk such nonsense sometimes, don't they? Women aren't angels, whatever they'd like you to think.
You mean Mrs. Kent was no angel?
I'll tell you what she was. She was dangerous.
Dangerous?
I don't mean wicked, nothing like that. But she was so pretty. Too pretty for her own good. Men buzzed round her like flies round a jam pot, and she loved it. She liked playing them off against each other, and some of them took her seriously. That's the trouble. It's funny how different people can be, isn't it? There's Jenny playing at love as if it were a kind of game. And then there's Fran. She's in love with you, Chris. Did you know that?
What? She tell you that?
She didn't have to.
Good Lord, are you sure? Because if she really...
Mr. Kent, I hate to interrupt you, but we are trying to conduct a criminal investigation. And the doctor has a few more questions to ask.
Yes, so I have, yes. One question about cards. The little cards the hotel gives you, with your room number and the prices and so on. I expect you have one, Mrs. Reaper?
No, I don't think so. Dan does that sort of thing. Oh, wait a minute. I believe they gave him some little cards like that because he's the host and he was paying for everything. I think he put them on the windowsill. Oh, they're not there now. The room was rather warm. They keep the central heating far too high. I had to open the window to get some fresh air. I expect that's when they all got blown about. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes, I think it probably does. Yeah, I also have a question about a key. The key to Mrs. Kent's room. It seems to be missing. I wonder if you knew where she kept it.
Oh, yes. I saw her put it in her bag last night.
Last night?
When we got back after the theatre. We were all going into our own rooms, and when I turned round to say good night to her, she was just opening her door, and then she dropped the key into her bag.
By George! You're sure of that?
The key was in her bag.
Oh, yes, I can see her now, unlocking the door. Her coat sleeve fell back, and I saw the bracelet she was wearing. White gold with a square black stone in it. I was quite surprised, because I'd never seen it before, and... What's the matter?
Are you saying Mrs. Kent was wearing Mrs. Jopley Dunn's bracelet?
No, I don't think so. Because I never heard of Mrs. Jopley Dunn, and I can't say I care for her name. But I do remember the bracelet, because it was so unusual.
Oh, for goodness sake, come in!
Superintendent, I'm sorry to disturb you, but I thought you should know. I've just spoken to Mrs. Jopley Dunn.
Oh, is she here? Have I met her?
No, madam. She's in Southampton. She described the bracelet she's lost. It's a different one altogether. It's made of silver, set with diamonds, worth £3,000, and she's positive she left it in that bureau. Naturally, she's very distressed, though she thinks her insurance will cover it.
So there were two bracelets in that bureau?
There must have been.
In that case, they were both stolen, because when Chris searched the bureau, it was empty. But between his leaving room 707 and you entering it, somebody returned Mrs. Kent's bracelet.
Well... All I can say is I never saw it until last night. Ask Fran. She was with us all the evening.
So Hadley and I went in search of Francine. We invited Chris to accompany us, but he seemed strangely diffident about it. After some humming and hawing, he decided he had a letter to write to his parents in Australia and retired to his own room. We finally ran Miss Forbes to earth in the Palm Court, where she was enjoying a sherry before lunch, and Hadley showed her the bracelet.
You're sure this bracelet belonged to Mrs. Kent?
Ah, yes, I'm quite sure.
And yet Mrs. Reaper says she never saw it before.
Well, she may have bought it in London recently. Perhaps this was the first time she'd worn it.
No, I don't think so. I believe she says she'd had it for years.
But she was definitely wearing it last night at the theatre.
Yes, she was. Perhaps Melita didn't notice it because Jenny kept her coat on all evening.
But you saw it. How was that?
It was before the theatre. I'd gone to her room to ask her what she was going to wear.
What time would that have been?
Oh, about 7 o'clock. She said she didn't feel like going out. She seemed a bit on edge.
You mean she was alarmed? Frightened?
No, I wouldn't say that. It would have taken a lot to frighten Jenny. But I asked her what was wrong.
No, can you remember exactly what she said?
I'll try. Let me think. She said she didn't really want to go to the theatre, but...
I don't really want to go to the theatre. It doesn't seem right so soon after Rod... Well, you know what I mean. But everyone else is going, and I certainly don't want to stay here on my own all the evening, so... What are you staring at?
Your bracelet. It's new, isn't it?
No, terribly old. But I don't often wear it.
Well, I thought I hadn't seen it before. May I?
Of course. Try it on if you want to.
Thank you. Well, how does it fasten? Oh, I see. There's an inscription on the stone. It's Latin, isn't it? I'm afraid I don't understand Latin.
Nor do I. But it has a very special meaning.
A sort of personal meaning?
Only if you're able to read it. That's the whole secret. Do you like it?
It's very unusual, but yes, I do.
Fran, if anything ever happens to me, oh... I don't suppose it will, but if it did, I'd like you to have it.
Was she a close friend of yours?
Not really. I'm not sure whether she even liked me. It was hard to tell with Jenny.
But now the bracelet will have a very special meaning for you.
Only if you're able to read it, that's the whole secret. I wonder what she meant by that.
Do you know of any love affair she might have had before her marriage or afterwards?
No, Jenny wasn't like that. I mean, she even disapproved of divorce.
You'd be surprised how devilishly respectable some murderers can be.
Surely you're not suggesting she...
I'm just putting forward a hypothesis. Mr. A falls in love with Mrs. B, but Mrs. B is far too respectable for a divorce. So she gets together with Mr. A... And they murder Mr. B.
No, that's ridiculous. If you mean Rod was
Bear
Mr.
with B- me for a moment. Now, suppose after the first murder, Mr. A and Mrs. B fell out. If Mr. A turned against Mrs. B, he might have a very strong motive for wanting her out of the way.
Well, I just said, one minute we're discussing matrimony, and the next you're plotting a double murder with a mythical Mr. A. If there was, or is, another man in the case, we ought to have found some trace of him by now, surely.
Well, perhaps we were looking in the wrong direction. Perhaps Mr. A gave Mrs. B the bracelet. I think if we find Mr. A, we'll be very close to finding the murderer.
Oh, no, you won't.
What? Sir Giles?
Forgive me, I couldn't help overhearing. I've been wondering whether to take the plunge and make a full confession. And now you've helped me make up my mind. All right, Superintendent. I'm the man you're looking for.
Look here. Now, if you're about to make a formal statement, I have to caution you.
Oh, no, I didn't kill her, if that's what you think. I was in love with her. And your reconstruction was at fault on one other point, the bracelet.
You mean you didn't give it to her?
No. She gave it to me.
In Part 1 of To Wake the Dead by John Dixon Carr, Dr. Gideon Fell was played by Donald Sinden and Superintendent Hadley by John Hartley. Sir Giles Gray, Richard Johnson. Chris Kent, David Brooks. Melita Reaper, Wendy Craig. Dan Reaper, John Rowe. Francine Forbes, Tracy Ann Oberman. Richie Bellows, Roger May. Kenneth Hardwick, Hugh Dixon, Jenny Kent, Sarah Rice. To Wake the Dead is dramatized for radio by Peter Ling and directed by Enid Williams.